All right, here we go. June 7, 2024. Common Sense Ohio, coming at you from a front porch in Circleville on North Court Street. But the show must go on. Norm's in the studio. Brett's on vacation. And we are brought to you, as always, by Harper Plus Accounting. My accountant could be yours, not only for your business needs, but your transactional needs as well. What's a transactional need, Norm? Well, that means when you just need a tax return filed and it's not that complicated, like you and I are, then you can just use the transactional side. So a little bit of everything for a little bit of something for everybody. You know, every day or every week we've been doing this World War II factoid. And I think today it's disingenuous to call what we're going to talk about a factoid. And I'm a day late and a dollar short, maybe as usual, but on yesterday was D-Day. And what was D-Day? Well, June 6, 1944, the United States of America and our men, our soldiers, our citizen soldiers saved the world. And you could say that sounds cheesy. It sounds cliche, but I think abundantly true. And Norm, before I turn it over to you, because I know you always have some great insight into this stuff, all sorts of people are playing all sorts of things. But one of the things that I heard was Reagan's speech, I think at the 50th anniversary. And he asked a question that was, I think, the most poignant question and the most, I don't know, thought-provoking question, maybe. And that is, where did we find such men? He says, one night after such an evening had ended, I asked Nancy, where did we find such men? And the answer came to me as quickly as I had asked the question. We found them where we've always found them, in our shops, on our farms, on our city streets, in our villages, and in our towns. And, you know, and I think it's a deeper question than that even. It's like, how are these men, how are these great men able to do this? I mean, I saw a picture of these guys in a boat, the Higgins boat, getting ready to jump on the beach and storm the beaches. I think, I can't remember the percentage, but that first wave, maybe 80% of them got shot and killed and slaughtered. They were 17, 18. You know, it's amazing. And then you look around today and you think, where would we find such men today? What would Reagan say? You know, like, could they do it? And, you know, I think it would be easy to say, there's no way we would find such men today, and the generation today couldn't do what the generation then did. But Norm, I don't think I'm going to go there. I think we could. I think that the American spirit is still there. It's still in the small towns. It's still in the farms, in the villages. It's just not what we see on the media anymore, and it's certainly not what is celebrated. So as we think about this, what could have been, you know, we were fighting literally, like, people throw around the term Nazi, but we were fighting Nazis. We were fighting people who wanted to take over the world for their own gain, anti-religious, anti-capitalist. They were fascists. They were essentially the fascist wing of the Socialist Party, and they were white supremacists, or at least Aryan supremacists. I mean, it's almost hard now to talk about this with our kids and explain how that really was. And, you know, and I remember for the first time studying this significantly in the 90s, and it blew me away when I really dug into it. But anyway, yesterday was D-Day, the day that changed the world, and the day that America, this horrible place with all this awful colonialism and all this awful, this awful history, we saved the effing world. And it's not an overstatement. All right, Norm, I'll shut up about it and let you give your insight.
Well, I second everything you just said. So today would be D-Day plus one. Halfway through D-Day, we had secured the beaches. So after that, it became, you know, can we get up off the beach and go into the hedgerow country and the very thick trees and scrub brush that defines France, that separates the farm fields. And that was tough going through the hedgerow country. But without getting into too much history, I don't want to differ from you about whether or not we have the kind of tough youth today that could muster a modern D-Day. But I am troubled by our culture. I think one of the reasons that generation, you know, kind of handily is called the greatest generation, and why they came together in unison to defeat not only the Nazis, but the Imperial Japanese and the Italian fascists, is because there was a shared value system. And I think that is the essential thing that's missing today, the essential thing that's worn away or has dissipated or we have let go as a culture. When they were interviewing some of the 100-year-old D-Day veterans, and there's just a handful left, and most of them won't be here. Maybe none of them will be here for the 90th anniversary. This was the 80th anniversary, if you can imagine. So they're almost all 100 years old plus. And almost to a person, when they were asked, you know, could America do this again, or do you feel like you saved the country and it was worth it? Those kinds of questions. And almost to a person, what I heard was that they don't recognize the America today. They almost every one of them said something like that or near to that they don't recognize their country anymore, and they're despondent about it and upset about it, and some of them just can't believe, like you mentioned, Steve, can we find the men to do this? Well, we can't even define what a man is. You know, much less gather together. You know, can you imagine these guys, you know, born in the 20s and 30s, 1920s, 1930s? I mean, they must just be blown away by the things our society is obsessed with today. You know, what bathrooms you can use, and can men shower in a girl's locker room because they're pretending to be a man? Or pretending to be a woman, excuse me. I mean, they just must wonder, what the hell? We got drag shows for children, you know, all this sickness in our society. And this isn't what they fought for. This is not the use of our precious democracy that we were supposed to apply to our lifestyle. We were supposed to stand up for other people. We were supposed to ensure that other people had their constitutional rights and ensure that they had the freedom to worship in the way they want and the freedom to say what they want. But we sure as hell, they were not fighting so that, you know, people could indulge and actually force other people to engage in some kind of weird fantasy that really is destructive to our children today. And the kids today are lost. You know, you and I have young sons, and I, you know, what I hear from my sons is terrible stuff. You know, their contemporaries are, many of them are lost. They're unsure of, you know, like they don't understand what a marriage is. They don't understand. They don't go to church. Most of them don't go to church. They don't know if there's a God or not. And I don't know, Steve. I think that could we militarily do a D-Day? Yeah, we might be able to do that. But, man, would we be united? Well, I don't know.
I don't know. And, you know, there's some irony in all this. We're not totally disagreeing, but I think... I like to think that the small towns, the small communities, we'll call it sort of the underbelly of our country is still there. And there's a groundswell of it. It's just, they're not always vocal. They're not the ones, you know, walking around screaming pride, pride, pride. Look at me, look at me, look at me. I want, I want, I want, whatever it is. They're the ones that are still going to work, still coming home, still going to the grocery store, going to church on Sunday, and doing what Americans always did. And I like to think that those people, when tapped on the shoulder or maybe shaken awake, will rise to the occasion. You know, of all things, Biden, of course, he's trying to save his campaign, and he makes this speech about how we have to save democracy. And he sort of equates, what he was really doing was equating Trump to Hitler, which is lunacy.
My God.
And he did make a comment, and Reagan made the comment, and lots of people have made the comment. It's like, it's only one generation away. You know, our freedom is one generation from being lost. And in some ways, you know, these great men who did this, the greatest generation, they came back, and within one or two generations, we see it whittling away.
Yeah.
And, you know, what Biden throws around this term democracy, we didn't even have a damn democracy, but I get what he's saying, what people say when they say democracy. But what we're really talking about is our freedom and the freedom to be free, I guess, to use the freedom from government authoritarian boot on our neck.
Right.
Where we can do whatever. And you know, it's Pride Month for whatever that's worth. And I believe in the freedom to go scream and say whatever you're going to do, as long as the government boot's not on your neck. I could disagree with the cause, but agree with the freedom to do it.
Yeah.
Think of the opposite side is doing the opposite.
Yeah. Think of that word pride. So the greatest generation, the guys, you know, who landed on D-Day, to them, pride was one of the seven deadly sins, right?
I mean, yeah. The worst. In fact, read C.S. Lewis about pride.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and it's like the worst of all.
Exactly. And the last thing they would want to do, I knew an 82nd Airborne paratrooper who's since passed away, and he landed behind the lines on D-Day, threw himself out of a C-47, middle of the night, you know, behind the enemy lines on D-Day. And, you know, I revered this guy. He was kind enough to, you know, share his story with hundreds, maybe thousands of school children, and explain to them what D-Day was and all that kind of thing. And he was the most humble, least prideful person that you could think of.
And if anybody could brag about what they've done in their life, it would be that guy.
Exactly. Right.
Right. Right.
He was humbled when somebody rang his doorbell and said, hello. His name was Don Jakeway. And this guy, his career in the U.S. Army was incredible. He received France's highest honor for a foreign combatant, you know, from the French government. He won the Silver Star. He was shot by a German sniper in Operation Market Garden after D-Day, of course. And then he recovered from that and went on to the Battle of the Bulge. This guy was unbelievable. And yet when somebody rang his doorbell and said, hey, Mr. Jakeway, can I come in and talk to you about military service, or, you know, see some of your artifacts and talk about World War II? He was humbled by that. He, you know, like it was reverse, yeah. Reverse pride. You know, it was
exactly right.
Yeah.
He was genuinely humbled by it.
He was genuinely humbled by it.
He wasn't just suppressing pride. He didn't have it.
No, and he was a servant to other people. That was the main thing that he learned, was that you serve other people. His son was a school principal, and naturally, you know, you can't imagine a public school principal being so busy. This Mr. Jakeway, into his 80s, would go over and mow his son's lawn at his house because he knew his son was just overwhelmed with work. That's the kind of human beings that landed on D-Day. I mean, they were guys that, till the day they died, they busted their ass, they gave back to their communities, and they did it quietly and with dignity. And you just, I don't know if those kinds of people exist. I hope they do. I mean, in large numbers.
I think they do.
I hope so.
Knock on wood, because of what these guys did, we have not been tested. I have not been tested like this, like they were.
Right.
What you said reminds me of a quote. I think it was Dick Winters from the 101st Airborne. And anybody, if you don't know, go watch Band of Brothers or read the book. And I think he was asked at one point, "Grandpa, are you a hero in the war?" And his answer was no, but I served in a company of heroes.
Right. And it's notable that Dick Winters did not write that book, right? I mean, he, right. In other words, it wasn't, hey, I'm going to write this, this war, you know, memoir, and it's all about me. I mean, people had to dig Dick Winters up out of the Pennsylvania, you know, countryside and remind people that Dick Winters and his band of brothers even existed. They were not known to the general public until that Stephen Ambrose and Tom Hanks series came out. I mean, otherwise people wouldn't even have known about him. I mean, that's
it's funny you say that because there was a neighbor of mine growing up in my neighborhood, and he had served in the war, and he was in the Battle of Bulge, and he had written, and a couple of his buddies had written separately their memoirs, sort of the battle story, the battle log. And I was fortunate enough for him to share that with me. And I say fortunate enough because he didn't want to share it, Norm. He didn't want to give it to people.
Right.
It was theirs, and it could be published, and he could have made money on it in a minute. I still have a copy of it. But he was very, very tight about sharing it. He didn't want, I never really quite figured out why, but I think you're onto it a little bit. Is it, you know, they were sort of humble about what they did. They didn't want nor need the recognition of how great they were to do that, because they just thought they were doing the job that they were called to do. And that was that, like, no different than you and I going to put in a day's work. It just, very, very humbling, which is the absolute opposite of pride.
Their value system was such that, I'm sure you heard this also, Steve, their value system was such that when these veterans talk about who the heroes are, like the Normandy American Cemetery, for example, that's just up the hill from Omaha Beach, they would say the real heroes are the 9,000 American servicemen.
They're still there,
the ones that are buried there, those are the ones in Arlington and scattered across the country in private cemeteries, the ones that gave their lives are the real heroes. And so I think their personal ethics were that they couldn't conceive trying to capitalize on that experience, knowing that or feeling that the real heroes were not them. Of course they were heroes, but they wouldn't call themselves
they got to come home.
That's right. And they would say, how can I make money off of this? And they were very uncomfortable with that, I think, generally. Yep. And I think that's a cultural thing versus, and I'm not going to put these guys down, like, you know, Marcus Luttrell and the other guys from the Afghanistan and Iraqi conflicts. You know, many of them, you know, two or three guys in the SEALs say that they're the ones that killed Osama bin Laden, for example. And there's they're dueling books about it. And it's a cultural shift. Those guys came back. They're like, hey, I'm a retired SEAL. I'm in my 30s. I'm not making a lot of money. Why don't I write a book about killing Osama bin Laden? And it's a different kind of thought process, a different value system. And I'm not saying those are bad guys, don't get me wrong, but our culture now has allowed for people to capitalize on experiences that, you know, ethically 50 years ago, guys would never dream of doing something like that. They wouldn't write a book like that.
And it's not, you know, maybe the difference is degree. World War II was an unprecedented war, and we'll never see anything like that again.
I hope not.
You know,
for God's sake.
The mechanics of it, the technology of it.
Yeah.
It still required literally hand-to-hand combat in ways that I don't think, you know, this is nothing to put down our current soldiers who have fought, obviously. But
right.
We're just a very, all the points of light emerged in one place to put these guys to the ultimate test. And they responded in a way that frankly, it's hard to even get your head around.
Yeah.
And for those who don't follow know the history, Hitler scoffed at the American men. Weak-kneed men who are soft because they have so much and we have so much abundance.
Right.
And we're so free. It's like those guys could never come and beat their disciplined army.
Right.
And not only did we beat them. You know, we beat them. And we beat them with the kind of ingenuity that developed as a result of our cultural systems, you know.
Right.
The farmers, for instance, you were talking about hedgerow country. The farmers that Reagan was talking about, where we found these guys, knew how to weld. And because they knew how to weld, they knew how to fix farm equipment. So they knew how to weld. And because they knew how to fix farm equipment and knew how to weld, when they ran into the hedgerows, they had the ingenious idea of welding big forks on the front of their tanks so they could plow through the hedgerows.
Right.
And they did that without seeking authority or approval from the dictatorship that Hitler was running.
Right.
And this is all, I'm taking this from a book written by Stephen Ambrose, who you acknowledged earlier,
yep.
called D-Day.
Yeah, that's called a cultivator. On the farms, they have these weeding tools that are called cultivators. And, you know, they can go down through the rows of corn in between and take out the weeds with these very sharp yep. teeth. And they figured out, hey, well, why don't we do something like that on the nose of a Sherman tank?
And what's fascinating is that if this were reversed, the Germans would not have been able to do that. And in fact, if you study D-Day, Hitler was asleep. I think it was his birthday, if I'm not mistaken. But nobody, he had all his troops down south. Didn't want to move him up. All the soldiers were saying, we got to get these guys up here.
Yeah.
And I think Rommel was home on visiting his wife.
Yep.
So they were sort of frozen in time, waiting on orders. And it's just the juxtaposition of that. The American ingenuity literally was able to adapt and overcome all these problems. And they didn't have to seek authority or to go take a crap, as you would say. You know, they would solve problems on their own. Hitler would never have allowed that.
Right.
And, you know, Hitler was insistent. He was right. I mean, just the reflection of leadership. And then, you know, I had to make some tough decisions this week in my job. And I'll shut up about this, but I had to. And as I was struggling over what to do, I had two competing offers and some deal. And, you know, I'm going back and forth and sort of frozen. And on June 5, I was toiling with this, and it wasn't lost on me that on June 5 in 1944, Eisenhower was thinking, are we going to have a weather break? Are we not going to have a weather break? I've got all these guys sort of at the ready, under lock and key. My entire army is here. We're going to cross. If we cross and the weather doesn't permit us, they're all going to get killed or they're going to get slaughtered. Are we going to have the opening? And, you know, the famous words are, we go, you know, he made a decision. And making decisions like that reflects character that I think not everybody has. You know, it's like, not only like I had to make a hard decision in my own personal life that only impacted me and maybe only impacted me financially. He was making a decision that impacted the entire free world, plus the lives of men and their families. I mean, it's, you know, people accuse me of sort of getting sappy about it, but I mean, it's mind boggling.
Yeah.
When you try to put yourself in that position, and these idiots today who scoff at it, stand on Eisenhower's shoulders, stand on the shoulders of these citizen soldiers, to use Ambrose's words, that saved their freedom, and then take a piss down at them and call them names for being bad colonists or whatever.
Right.
It's like, it is, they would do well to reflect on what these guys did and not piss down on what these guys did. So
yeah,
we can move on from there.
I would just like to relate very quickly a little story I heard from Karl Rove, of all people. He was there when Reagan was giving his, or actually it was George W. Bush was giving his D-Day speech. And he ran into he was an older man, of course, at that time. But when he enlisted in the U.S. Army after Pearl Harbor, he was only 15. And so he convinced his father was a coal miner in Hazard County, Kentucky. And this 15-year-old boy went to his dad and said, I want to fight. I want to fight. I want to fight these people that just hit America. And he's 15. His dad said, well, I'll go down to the recruiting station with you. I'll sign the papers to say you're 18. and we'll just keep it between us, because this boy looked older than he was. So on
it is.
So
go ahead.
So on D-Day, so he went into the army in like 43 or whatever, but he was inspired by the events of Pearl Harbor. On D-Day minus one, he was still 15. On D-Day itself, he turned 16. And his fellow army, the raiders that, you know, landed on D-Day, they celebrated, they sang happy birthday to him in the basement of a blown up French chateau in Normandy. Can you imagine?
I got to tell you.
Can you imagine?
It's hard for me to even have these conversations without choking up. I mean, it really is.
Can you imagine?
I mean, you look at kids today.
Right.
And they think that they're squirrels or rabbits or dogs, and they're identified as this or that, and they want to go use the women's room instead of the men's room. And look, I should say as an aside, I really don't care how you identify. I could really care less. If you're homosexual or not homosexual, it really doesn't make any difference to me. And please, you know, anybody who see, you could take clips out of this conversation, Norm, and they could skewer us with it. But I think you and I both agree on that. You have a freedom to be who you want to be.
Well,
but yeah, it's a reflection that we're celebrating,
right?
This sort of like, where is that now? Can you imagine any of the 15-year-olds now signing up to put a rifle in their hand and go,
yeah,
storm the beach of Normandy?
Right. Right.
You know, at 15, and maybe, you know, maybe it was different when I was 15, but, you know, we were a little more independent, and I'm not saying I could have done it. I don't know, but it seems a little bit less of a stretch when I was 15, and probably less of a stretch even more so when you were 15, but now it doesn't even seem like a realistic scenario at all. I mean,
no.
It doesn't even seem like it would be in the realm of possibility.
No.
And certainly our parents who are overprotecting our kids would never, ever do that.
Right.
It reflects a value structure that our country was worth it. It was worth it.
Right.
The cause was worth it. And I think right now the danger is if we were called to do something like that, our kids have been taught now for several generations, our country's not worth it. It's not, it's a terrible place with a history steeped in all this horribleness.
Yeah. And so Steve, I agree with everything you said, but I would reword it just slightly. So I love all these people. Whether they think they're kitty cats or they're a homosexual or they're a tranny or whatever they are, I love all of humanity and most sincerely, and I do love them in a Christian way. I love them. However, I do care. I do care that they are so misguided and so misdirected that they have chosen some of those lifestyles. And I know many are taken very sincerely after a lot of prayer and a lot of counseling and a lot of psychological help, and they've decided to go a certain lifestyle. So I know for some people that that's a very considered and very difficult decision, and I'm not downplaying that. But I do care about the sickness that our society celebrates. Like when somebody makes that decision, why isn't it just done quietly? Like,
well, that's right. Why does it have to be a prideful decision?
Well, there's not a National White Person's Month. There's not a
nor should there be.
Nor should there be. And there's not, and a lot of
we have Memorial Day.
And
right? we celebrate bigger causes than the individual. I think that's really what we're getting at.
Yeah, and not a National Heterosexual Day. I mean,
what? Nor should there be.
Nor should there be. I don't understand why these lifestyle decisions aren't done privately, quietly.
Well,
just like yours and mine are quiet and private. What we do is private. I don't understand.
There's a little bit of economics at play. And, yeah, you know, from an economic standpoint, believe it or not, who was the coach of the Bears? Ditka?
Oh, George Halas?
No, I'm going to Mike Ditka. You had a saying one time that I heard one time.
Oh, Ditka, like, yeah.
Yeah. You tolerate or you endure what you tolerate. And I think there's, to take that even deeper, economically speaking, if you pay for something, you're going to get more of it. So when we subsidize a behavior, even under the guise of trying to help people, you're only going to encourage the behavior. And this is sort of an extension of that. We're celebrating kids who are too young to even know, you know, what shoes to put on.
Right.
We're celebrating their absurd decisions. So you're going to get more of that. Like, if you celebrate that, you're going to get more of it.
Exactly.
If you pet your dog every time you bite somebody, you're going to get more of it. Right. I mean, it just is.
Right.
Not to call kids dogs, but, and again, I'll be misquoted on this, but the point is that if you celebrate or pay for a behavior or reward a behavior, you're going to get more of it.
Yes. You
it
will.
Would not have been tolerated for me to run around acting like a chipmunk or a rabbit or a dog in my household.
Right.
And it wouldn't have been tolerated. Like it wouldn't have even been a decision. It just would have been, no, there would have been no struggle over this. Oh, my kid thinks he's a dog. No, you're not a dog. Shut up.
Well, there's this weird thing where we like to celebrate the underdog, and it's been perverted to the point that when somebody has a mental disorder, okay, and they overcome other people's disapproval that they're acting out, that somehow we call that, oh, you're brave. Oh, you're a hero. And they walk on the stage at Oprah or, you know, one of those wax shows. Yeah. And people,
was it Easter that Biden was calling everybody, like, these are the real heroes, or these are the real bravery. These are the bravest people in the country. It's like,
what?
Come on.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. Like, there are some acts, there are some things that you do in life that you should be ashamed of. And I'm not speaking about anything in particular. We could go through it one by one, and I'd say, yeah, that's a shameful act or not, if we want to do that. But that's just based on my morality. But I think there's some things in general, like, okay, Ohio's got this House bill, for example, Steve. Here's a transition, no pun intended. House Bill 245. And what they're trying to do is, because it's always been illegal to take a child into a strip club or a drag show where there's nudity and where there's prurient activity, simulated sex, or even actual sex, it's always been illegal to take a child into one of those kinds of bars or emporiums. But now our society is so sick that the emporium and the strip clubs are now being brought out into the open. And so legislators are trying to retune the indecency laws. And House Bill 245 is basically saying, if you publicly perform an indecent act where you're nude or you're simulating nudity with, prosthetic penises or whatever, and you do that in front of a child under 13 years old, it's a misdemeanor. And it can be up to a felony of a fourth or fifth degree, depending on how extreme it is. And so, like, that kind of conduct, you can imagine a 100-year-old World War II D-Day veteran. They couldn't even imagine somebody could come out and do that in public at a park.
Yeah.
And nice suburban moms would sit around that performer and clap their hands, thinking that they're somehow virtuous because they're allowing this to be rewarded with their applause. And I mean, this is how crazy our culture's gotten. And people will, so in four states, Montana, Florida, Tennessee, and Texas, judges have thrown out these kinds of laws that they're considering in Ohio under free speech. But I mean, what the hell do you do when the indecency is coming out of the club into the public forum? I mean, our society is up in the air right now because on one hand we want to preserve our constitutional rights, but on the other hand, people are doing stuff that's just very deleterious to raising children in any kind of moral. I don't know what to say.
We were founded with a certain value structure, and at the same time we founded our kind of constitution, it was sort of implicit that it only works if we operate with a common value system.
Yes.
And we can't legislate that. You can't dictate that. You can't cram that down. That's sort of the irony of this, is that we can't cram down, you better believe this, but we all did believe this. And it started with a certain structure, and you know, you can argue about it all you want, but it was a Judeo-Christian backdrop.
right.
of values.
Right.
And
right.
once we get rid of that, like what keeps it together? Like, you know, because freedom, like Marx said it, a capitalistic society contains the seeds to its own destruction. And to some extent, and maybe only on that, he was right. Because if you give people the freedom to do whatever they want, and what they want to do is take down the government, eventually they're going to get to a foothold. And that's what's happened.
Yeah.
Or not the government, but the structure of our community. So since World War II, we don't go to church anymore.
Yeah.
Since World War II, we don't have a common value system where two parents at home is encouraged. We don't have a, you know, we've sort of abandoned all these notions where Reagan said we found these men. You know, it's like, well, maybe we can't, like I heard Ben Shapiro talking about the other day. And he's like, well, he likened it to, well, we don't have this anymore because we can't find these men anymore because we don't have these structures in place anymore. And the people want the left wants to dismantle it. They want to do just the opposite, which is what Marx wanted to do. So, you know, and at the same time, they're calling it democracy, which is the most absurd Orwellian moniker that you can use, right? To
sure.
sort of cram down authoritative, you better believe this or you're a bad person.
You know, Steve, one of the aspects that Ambrose never really addressed in his books, and I've read, I don't know, four or five of them, the Air Force One, Citizen Soldiers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He wrote a lot of books. Some were great. Some were kind of, but at any rate, he was a good historian for the most part. And one of the things I don't think too many historians have ever really broached was, and I think the quote you had there from Ben Shapiro is right on target. Yeah, you bring up a great point. One of the things, almost to a man, I am sure, I mean, I'm positive of this, that those D-Day servicemen, we 2,500 were killed on D-Day. So if you could somehow cosmically take a microphone to the 2,500 who died and ask them, do you believe in an afterlife? Do you believe that, you know, Jesus came, sacrificed himself, etc., so that someday if you lived a good life, you would go to heaven? That's a basic Christian, you know, a motif of going on. If you serve
well,
God,
Judeo-Christian, right? Because living a good life, like you're including the
yes, I would include Jews as well. Yes, absolutely. And all Christian faiths, that basically if you adhere to the Ten Commandments and live a good life, if you die young, like in a war, you know, giving yourself up for your fellow man to save mankind, the final act of devotion that Abraham Lincoln talked about, almost to a person, those 2,500 would say, yes, I believe I will go to heaven or some version of heaven. And maybe 10% would be atheists, but I bet you about 90% would say, oh yeah, I believe what the parson back home in my little, you know, Baptist church or Presbyterian church or Catholic church would, I believe what they say, that if I'm a good boy, I'll go to heaven.
Yep.
That's how,
I think how selfish.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm talking this through as I think it through, but you're onto something there. It's like, it's very atheism can, I think it leads to selfishness. So if there is nothing else,
yeah.
If there's nothing else, why right. would you ever sacrifice one second of time on this planet to do anything other than for yourself?
Right. It's just a dirt nap. You're just going to go and do a dirt nap and the worms will eat you and there's nothing beyond this. Well, then why have any kind of moral code? Like just pleasure yourself.
Just, these are the Bacchanalians, you know, the hedonists. Do whatever you want to make yourself happy in the moment.
Right.
And it's what's interesting about that, and this is turning into a philosophical podcast, but I think that's okay.
Yeah, it's good. This is good.
What's interesting about that is, contrary to our human experience, or at least my human experience, I never feel good after an overindulgent experience. And we've all done this. You know, we all eat too much. We all drink too much at some point in your lives, or you engage in some behavior that you know is grossly indulgent. You know, it's like when there's too much sugar.
Yeah.
We feel sick.
Right.
And I never feel good after that. So yeah, you know, YOLO, you only live once, go do whatever, be a hedonist. I never wake up feeling like, man, that was awesome. You always wake up feeling like I always feel like I fell a little bit short. I don't feel like that after a hard weekend of work, accomplishing something that is not indulgent, but even like maybe even helping your buddy move his house. You're thinking, hey, you might think, man, I could have done so many other things this weekend, but I engaged in this work and I helped somebody and it was a hard task, but we got through it. You feel effing awesome.
Yes, you do.
When I happen to be working on a house in Circleville, I meet some people down here on it today. And, it's been some of the hardest labor I've had in the last couple of years. But when I'm done on the weekends, I feel awesome. I feel, you know, you feel like you've got something done.
Yeah.
And when I always feel that way when I accomplish a task at work, whether it's because I'm getting paid to do it or whether it's because it's a project or I'm helping somebody else. I never get that feeling when I've overindulged in some sort of selfish behavior.
I agree with you totally. I have the same feeling, you know, even if it's a vacation where, you know, like the whole point is to have fun, right? You know, some of those all-inclusive resorts just make me feel terrible because it's like you're walling off other people and it, like there's this special little spot where you can, you know, indulge yourself in, you know, in every kind of activity that you want and the rest of the world won't intrude. Reality won't intrude. And it's not a good feeling to me. It's
absolutely not.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a very, so you could say, you know, that's a very Christian value and Judeo-Christian value, really.
Yeah.
Even Old Testament.
Yeah. Right.
So does the Old Testament, and the New Testament, do they, you know, does it imitate the human experience or does the human experience imitate the other? You know, what is it? Is it both? That's what makes the biblical experience, if you happen to go read it and ponder it, I mean, really read it and ponder it, so deep. Like it's such an incredible truth. It's hard to say. Is it reflecting somebody's understanding of how humans are, or is it God talking about how humans are? You know, it's like, it's so, it's such an incredible philosophical exercise to drill down on that. But, you know, all I know is my lived experience. And I think everybody's lived experience is overindulgence leads to disappointment and selfless behavior leads to satisfaction, not happiness, but satisfaction, right?
Right.
So living a satisfied life,
right.
Living a life that you felt was worth living.
Right.
And if you're not willing to say there's something more after this, why would you ever make any sacrifice today?
Right. I was talking to a young 20 something young lady that, doing some gardening work, some household, chores and, you know, we're having lunch and, talking about, you know, what's it like out there for young people that are looking to have some kind of, you know, a family or looking to move past being single. What's it like? And she said, basically, it's a hookup culture, that overwhelmingly hookup culture, that people don't really date anymore. And makes me very sad because I kind of said to her, like, you know, part of my life, you know, I've had disasters and I've had triumphs. I've, you know, ups and downs, but at the end of the day, none of the crap, your house you're building or a racing car or artwork on the walls or these podcasts, you know, nothing will go on and be as significant as having children who hopefully carry forward your value system or at least some kind of value system that you can call a positive system, a positive view, a positive way to live their lives. That's really the only thing we get to leave behind. Because I'm not the president. Nobody's going to build a statue to Steve or Norm.
Norm, maybe me.
But I mean, you know, our legacy is really our families. And at the end, you know, in this poor young girl, you could tell some of the sadness in young women today is they're instinctively wanting to have some kind of a nest, some kind of
connection, connection. They want something and bigger than them.
I see a lot of sadness in young people today, particularly young women, and they seem to be rebelling in very strange ways. They're in these marches yelling about Hamas and things they don't even understand with clenched fists, and they're marching around, and they're very, a lot of them lead very soft lives. They're very well funded. And you wonder, what are they so angry about? And I think a lot of it is, yeah, like there's no civil rights issues really left.
But there's a hole. There's a hole in their soul, you know.
Exactly.
Well, look at it this way: you're onto something, and it's a punctuating the point we've been talking about. Is that if there is nothing else, if this is it, and you're taught that this is it, and you fundamentally believe that, you're going to feel something a little bit wrong because this isn't it. But beyond that, if you're not willing to make any, if this is it, why would you sacrifice anything?
Yeah.
Other than for yourself, and if that's your attitude, it is inherently inconsistent with a traditional relationship, because that is wrought with sacrifice. If you don't think there's sacrifice in trying to make a life with another human being, you know, you've got to compromise, you've got to work,
right.
If you're a guy, then you're sacrificing your instinct to go be philandering around with others. If you're a woman, you're sacrificing, you know, you're going to raise kids and give yourself to that. You know, there's so much sacrifice involved in a relationship. Why would you do that, Norm, with today's standards?
Right.
You know, I'm sort of facetiously, but really, why do that at all? And then if you're not going to do that at all because you believe that this is it, you're going to be left with a hole, because what we're talking about is our satisfaction, at least my satisfaction, comes at the end of the sacrifice and the hard work. It doesn't come at the end of an indulging experience. Right. And if you never give yourself the satisfaction of having persevered over adversity because everything is self-indulgent, then you're going to be miserable. And I know this because I've lived it.
Yes.
I've done it both ways. We all have, because none of us are perfect.
None of us is perfect. That's right.
And I just know that I feel better when I make sacrifices and do things not only for myself, but for others, and do things just for the sake of doing them sometimes.
Yeah.
There's a hard job there in front of, like, Kennedy wasn't my favorite president, but, you know, he said, we do these things not because they're easy, because they're hard. And he was sort of onto something with that. You know, it's like, we do these things because they're difficult, and there's satisfaction at the end of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of Kennedy, if I can transition this a little bit, there's some pretty scary stuff going on between us and Russia again, of course. Mm-hmm. And I think some of what Biden was talking about at his D-Day speech was somehow comparing, you know, the Soviet, well, Russia, I almost said Soviet, Russia, in the invasion into Ukraine as somehow parallel to Nazi Germany invading Poland. And I get that there are some parallels. I'm a student of history. I understand that. But at the same time, John Kennedy presided over the Cuban Missile Crisis. And just this week, the country of Cuba has announced that, here we go again, Russian warships are now going to be stationed and docked and serviced out of Cuba. And this is kind of new.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
This is kind of new. And what also came out this week was Anthony Blinken, you know, we go back to the Fulda Pass, you know, and U.S. strategy to fight the old Soviet Union after World War II. We were going to send tanks through the Fulda Gap, you know, and into Russia, you know, through Germany and into Russia. Well, here we go again. It's come out two things that the Defense Department is working on quick deployment plans for a U.S. invasion or response to an invasion of Europe by Russia. And number two, Biden has okayed the use of U.S. weapons given to Zelensky, given to Ukraine. They are now allowed to use U.S.-made military weapons within a 200-mile zone within Russia. And Putin has said in response to that, oh, well, if American hardware is going to start blowing up Russian citizens within a 200-mile zone, maybe we ought to look to doing that in kind. And here we go, Russian warships in Cuba, which is not very far from, Florida.
I mean, look, you can make some arguments about Kennedy and what Khrushchev thought about Kennedy being sort of weak and that he could take advantage of Kennedy. And there's probably some truth to that. But Biden, is that the guy you want to try to put you want on the Hill putting a stop to this? I mean, really? I mean, that guy doesn't even know how to exit stage left. And, you know, I think we've sort of created a vacuum in the world with our weakness that will leave room for this kind of crap. And, you know, I think you've said it, Norm, or somebody said it. It's like, it's easy to dismantle this stuff and it's so difficult to build it back.
Yeah.
And, you know, that our strength in the world has been dismantled in such a way that it's going to be very difficult to get it back.
I mean, you know, hello, people. Russia has thermonuclear weapons, right? They are the last country that I would want to provoke into a war, because it you're talking, people overuse the word existential. If we have a nuclear exchange with Russia because of Biden's incompetence, there is no way American weapons should be used to attack Russia. No way. I mean, the only use for those weapons should be defensive, being used to repel Russia out of Ukraine. Okay, there's a bright line there. But to send our weaponry into a sovereign state that we're manufacturing, and for it to come out that Biden has given Zelensky permission to do that, I mean, you got to be crapping me. I mean, these people have thermonuclear weapons.
Biden, has Biden ever done anything right when it comes to foreign policy? I mean, ever.
Yeah.
His entire career. I think the answer is invariably no. I mean, the guy blunders around following whatever cause of the day he thinks will get him more likes.
Right.
And that's about it. He's always been that way, even before there was a such thing as likes.
He
just sort of sniffs where he thinks the support is coming.
Yeah, yeah. And the Cold War, and Biden ought to know this, right? He was a senator for 49 years or some godforsaken number. That Biden ought to know that the Cold War was predicated on the mutually assured destruction, or MAD theorem, that if Russia let go of a bunch of their thermonuclears in a first strike, we would respond in kind. And now we're tiptoeing up on this by allowing conventional weapons to be, I mean, we've never done that, not since the White Revolution in Russia, where we landed U.S. troops in some city way up north in Russia during the Russian Civil War, and we tried to take the side against the Bolsheviks. But since then, we have not sent conventional weapons other than Lend-Lease to help Russia defeat Hitler.
Right.
We the idea that we're sending weaponry to be used.
Well, it's an act of war, right? I mean,
dude, it really is. I mean,
it's an act of war.
I mean, come on.
So,
I mean, we're playing with, I mean, this is, we're dancing with the devil here. And Putin, Putin is rumored to have cancer, or he's fatal. You know, he's somehow sick. I mean, who knows what a madman like him might do on the way out?
Or who's coming next?
Right. Yeah.
You know, this is just bad, bad, bad foreign policy. Well, look, Norm, we're about an hour in. When I hit a couple quickies, and then we can.
Yeah, I would like. So here's a real positive thing, because we've talked about some heavy duty stuff, but really positive First Amendment rights. It's decision 9-0 by the Supreme Court about 2 weeks ago. As you know, we had the FOP in last week, so we couldn't talk about some of the other news, not enough time. But the National Rifle Association won its case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court because the New York Department of Insurance was telling private insurance companies not to do business with the NRA, and it was determined that it was because of the NRA's political positions, their free speech. And this commissioner of the insurance in New York was telling She was taking government action, official government action on, you know, on her stationery under her aegis to tell private insurance companies don't work with the NRA. The NRA offers all kinds of little insurance policies, life, you know, theft, other kinds of insurance to its membership. And she was saying, hey, here in New York, we don't want you to do business with them. So the NRA took her to court and 9-0.
And the key to this is, as always in these analytical questions, is government action. So just to clarify, what was going on here is that there was a government entity in the form of like deep state type government stuff, you know, some department that is acting as an arm of the government, telling or enforcing, or we'll put it in quotes, encouraging private insurance companies not to do business with certain entities. And, you know, that because of their political stance. And so the question in any First Amendment, so for instance, when, what's his name? Kneeled in front of the kneeled during the national anthem during NFL games.
Kaepernick.
Kaepernick. Everybody was up in arms about this when the NFL wanted to stop it, or could they stop it? Does he have a right of free speech to do that? The answer is no. There is no. He had no right of free speech to kneel at an NFL game, and the NFL, if they wanted to, could have stopped it. The government could not have. The government could not have made that unlawful, but the private entity could have. This is what you're talking about, is a governmental entity telling private entities to take action against another entity because of its political speech. And that is where the government action comes from. So good decision. And I'd like to see it's 9-0 that we still have, especially after was it Ketanji Brown Jackson who said recently in a debate that, you know, these free speech laws are really getting in the way of the governmental power. I think that was almost a quote. You know, it's like, yeah, that's the point. Read the First Amendment. It comes first. It's you can find it really easily.
Hey, Steve, you know who wrote the opinion on that was Sotomayor, believe it or not.
Oh, great.
She
good
wrote
to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, she wrote the opinion, and I'm damn glad she did. Thank you. You know? So you know, we could talk about Hunter and Biden and Trump's case and some other things. Why don't we do that next week when you're back in the studio?
Yeah, we'll do a breakdown of the Trump appellate process, whether he's going to jail, and we'll talk about Hunter's case.
Yeah.
Hunter's case got some nuance, but those will be more of some quick legal breakdowns. But yeah, I think it's a good place to wrap it up. I intended to talk about that stuff today, but I think D-Day and Normandy and, you know, the greatest that philosophical discussion was worthy of having. So I'm glad we did it.
Yeah. Thank you for your contributions, as always. Very, same. Very massive. And, you know, I think it's important. I don't know if there's anything more important than really what our morals and our ethics and our beliefs, our cultural togetherness requires us to do more than just tolerate other people. If all we do is tolerate people, then we're really not bound together in any kind of way.
Yep. But always remember here, you know, all is not lost here. We've got at least half the country, and I think more than half the country, still loves the country. And I think a lot more than half. And I think there's a lot of people who are misguided, who sort of celebrate this notion that we're horrible, but they don't really believe it. And then you've got a small, I'm hoping a smaller minority of people who actually do believe that and are actively working to dismantle it. But, you know, we've got to work in the swing areas, you know, in those we can get. You're never going to get the extremists, but at least, you know, exposure to that type of history maybe is the first step. You know, we're not so bad. But anyway, with that, we're going to wrap it up. It's been Common Sense Ohio, June 7th, D-Day plus one, 2024, brought to you by Harper Plus Accounting, where we are coming at you from the heartland, Ohio. That is the heartland of Ohio, or is that right? Ohio is the heartland, whatever the hell it is.
The heart of it all.
We're coming at you, the heart of it all. We're coming at you from the heart of it all, right from the middle, each and every week, at least until now.